It's freezing, he squealed. My legs are going numb. Of course it's freezing. It has ice in it. Now push this truck. It stinks. Push! It took Leon a moment to make his way behind the vehicle, and the footing beneath the surface was clearly uneven. Once he nearly plunged all the way under and had to grab the fender to stay upright. His robes were a mess, his hands and face pale, his hair mussed. Rayford could see he was shivering to his core. When he got behind the Humvee, Carpathia apparently floored the accelerator, for all he accomplished was to kick up a rooster tail of liquid and steam that covered Leon. The Humvee didn't move. "Try to rock it!" Leon shouted. "That is what you are there for. Grab under the bumper and lift. Lift a Humvee. Rock it." Finally, they coordinated Leon's lifting and pushing, and Carpathia's alternated gunning the engine and letting up, and the big thing began to sway. When it finally started to move, Leon lost his balance and pitched forward, going completely under. He came up sputtering and wiping his face, which only smeared it. Nikolai pulled the Humvee to slightly higher ground, and Leon rushed to get in the passenger side. But when he opened the door, Carpathia was already there. "I am not driving, Leon. How would that look?" Leon trudged around in front of the car and yanked open the door. Just before climbing in, he pulled his sodden robe over his head and left it in the rising river of blood. He clambered aboard in his underwear, assuring Nikolai that he had other clothes in the back. "Well, put them on immediately." The Humvee rocked and bounced as Leon found dry clothes and dressed in the car. Apparently deciding his ornate cap wouldn't work with the new outfit, he tossed it out the window as he slowly pulled away, looking for yet higher ground. The blood had already risen over 4 feet. When the skies cleared and the temperatures rose, Mac rubbed his bare arms and emerged from what had been meager cover under sparse trees not far from the Temple Mount. Though not in the uniform of the Unity Army, he must not have looked like a rebel either, as he was virtually ignored. Many of the normal non-fighting citizenry were milling about among the thousands of soldiers who spent much of their time sitting around. Some platoons were moved here and there, seemingly on the whim of a general or a commander, but all fighting had ceased. The global community forces had occupied all of Jerusalem except the Temple Mount, and they had that surrounded. Occasionally, a general with a bullhorn tried to persuade the tiny band of rebels inside to surrender and avoid inevitable bloodshed. Mac was amused that the general assumed the rebels had no access to outside information. But having fought with them, he knew they had radios and even some televisions. They would know what had happened at Petra and Busaira, and soon they would probably even know the outcome of the battle at Armageddon. It seemed weird to Mac that soldiers could sit around smoking and playing cards, only occasionally glancing into the sky to see what Jesus was up to. Maybe this was all part of the hardening of hearts, but Mac thought that he, in the same situation, would recognize that his end was near. Theirs was clearly a supernatural foe who hadn't even been slowed by the most powerful army in history. The war was as good as over. And yet Nikolai Carpathia, the great deceiver, despite winning not even a skirmish since the appearing of Christ, had somehow convinced his troops that Jerusalem was the key. If they could take the holy city, he would be returned to his rightful throne, the Son of God would be defeated, and all would again be right with the world. The only thing that argument had going for it was the current situation in Jerusalem. The idea of the rebels holding anything when they were surrounded and outnumbered 1,000 to 1 was laughable and pathetic. Except, as Mac knew, they were on the right side. Rayford had assumed he was way past being shocked by now. What could he see that would be more surreal than the last several hours? Yet as Abdullah kept a careful but watchful distance from Carpathia's Humvee, all Rayford could do was stare at the result of the last so-called battle. Of course, there hadn't been a battle at all. The Unity Army had rattled its sabers, loaded its weapons, and made a lot of noise, and Jesus had killed them all with mere words. Of course, those words were the words of God, and the effect was overpowering. Mile after mile after mile, Abdullah drove next to a river of blood, several miles wide and now some 5 feet deep. Carpathia's whole world fighting force of several million troops had been reduced to perhaps a million. That was still huge, of course, and from a human standpoint, the rebels could never match it. But the devastation to the Unity Army in a short period should have made plain to Carpathia that his days were numbered. Rather, to hear him talking earnestly to Leon in the car and to the remaining troops by radio, what had happened served as mere motivation. "Our goal remains," Carpathia said, "and our task is clear. Take the Father's city, wipe out his chosen people, and kill his son. This has been our design from the beginning. We have drawn him out, and we will soon have him where we want him. Remain loyal, remain true, remain vigilant, and you will be rewarded." Jesus, meanwhile, had turned to the remnant and addressed them directly as Rayford and Abdullah listened. "You are of God, little children, and have overcome Antichrist, because he who is in you is greater than he who is in the world. He is of the world. Therefore he speaks as of the world, and the world hears him. You are of God. He who knows God hears me. He who is not of God does not hear me. By this you know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error. Beloved, love one another, for love is of God, and everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. He who does not love does not know God, for God is love. In this the love of God was manifested toward you, that God has sent his only begotten Son into the world, that you might live through him. In this is love, not that you loved God, but that he loved you and sent me to be the propitiation for your sins. Rayford, if God so loved you, you also ought to love one another." Rayford was always pierced when he heard his name, as he knew Abdullah and all the others had to be, and wasn't it just like the Lord to move from that little personal exhortation to clearly explain what had just happened? "And they gathered them together to the place called in Hebrew Armageddon. Then the seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air, and a loud voice came out of the temple of heaven from the throne, saying, 'It is done.' And there were noises and thunderings and lightnings, and great hail from heaven fell upon men, each hailstone about the weight of a talent. Men blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail, since that plague was exceedingly great. An angel came out of the temple of heaven, crying to me with a loud voice, 'Thrust in your sickle and reap, for the time has come for you to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe.' So I thrust in my sickle on the earth, and the earth was reaped. Then another angel came out of the temple which is in heaven, he also having a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the altar who had power over fire, and he cried with a loud cry to him who had the sharp sickle, saying, 'Thrust in your sharp sickle and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe.' So the angel thrust his sickle into the earth and gathered the vine of the earth and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trampled outside the city, and blood came out of the winepress up to the horses' bridles for 1,600 furlongs. The remnant, full of the glory of God, had been turned and was pointed toward Jerusalem. Chaim believed the Lord would protect them, but strangely, Jesus now moved on ahead with his army. And while the children of Israel seemed to be moving supernaturally fast again, they fell far behind him and soon lost sight of him. Chaim noticed others looking at each other with concern, and he wanted to reassure them. But his place as leader and spokesman had been taken, and he felt no prompting to try to reassert himself. His job was done, and he felt he was just part of the remnant now. They would go where God pointed them and trust the Lord to be their rear guard. Mac was surprised to discover that the radio waves, and he assumed television as well, were still controlled by the global community. That, he knew, would not last long. As he made his way throughout Jerusalem, trying to give Rayford and Abdullah a picture of what they'd find when they arrived, he listened to GC reporters and anchors putting Nikolai Carpathia's spin on everything. There was no mention, of course, of what could have at least been described as an apparition in the sky, some trick by the enemy to scare everyone. Talk about the proverbial elephant in the room. Mac was certain everyone on Earth knew who rode on the clouds. The question was what Jesus was going to do and when he was going to do it. Jerusalem was replete with makeshift jails and prisons and holding tanks where the captured rebels were starved and tortured. GC personnel reported on these with apparent glee as evidence that victory was at hand. One commentator said that the rebels who thought they were holding the Temple Mount area were themselves in only a larger prison of their own making, for they were helpless to stand against the Unity Army. And there was nowhere they could flee. It was apparent to Mac that word was beginning to spread throughout the city that the potentate was on his way. The place became a center of activity. Card games ended. Sitting around became a thing of the past. Platoons were coming to attention, areas policed, and the path to the front lines cleared. Every few minutes, the news carried a fresh, live quote, right from the Commander-in-Chief's own vehicle. "As we approach what many have referred to as the Eternal City," Carpathia said, "I am pleased to announce that following our victory here, this shall become the new global community headquarters. My palace shall be rebuilt on the site of the ruins of the temple, the destruction of which is on our agenda. As beautiful as New Babylon was, in truth it has been my objective all along to one day relocate the seat of government, commerce, and religion to this city, which has meant so much to so many for so long. So, loyal citizens of the New World Order, I trust you will watch with great satisfaction as we complete our takeover of this place, as we root out and destroy the last pocket of resistance, and as we render impotent the one whom the enemy reveres as the reason they have never been able to join our noble cause. This one who flits about in the air quoting ancient fairy tale texts and forcing sycophants to mindlessly run along worshipping him will soon meet his end. He is no match for the risen Lord of this world and for the fighting force in place to face him. It doesn't even trouble me to make public our plan, as it has already succeeded. This city and these despicable people have long been his chosen ones, so we have forced him to show himself, to declare himself, to vainly try to defend them or be shown for the fraud and coward that he is. Either he attempts to come to their rescue, or they will see him for who he really is and reject him as an impostor. Or he will foolishly come against my immovable force in me and prove once and for all who is the better man. While I do not expect this to be an extended campaign, as this is the last battle I ever hope to wage, I am bringing in the whole of our resources. Every man and woman under my command and every armament and munition at our disposal shall be employed to make this the most resounding and convincing military victory in history. My pledge to you, loyal citizens of the global community, is that come the end of this battle, no opponent of my leadership and regime will remain standing. Yea, not one will be left alive. The only living beings on planet Earth will be trustworthy citizens, lovers of peace and harmony and tranquility, which I offer with love for all from the depths of my being. I am but 10 miles west of Jerusalem as we speak, and I will be dismissing my cabinet and generals so they may be about the business of waging this conflict under my command. The Most High Reverend of Carpathianism, Dr. Leon Fortunato himself, will serve as my chauffeur for my triumphal entry. Citizens are already lining the roadway to greet me, and I thank you for your support. Mac hurried into position where he could get a look at the Humvee and the motorcade of military vehicles following it. He stood on a rise on the west side, where he could see the parading army that extended to the horizon. As the procession neared the city, he could hear drums and trumpets, and if he wasn't mistaken, even from that distance, the Royal Humvee looked a mess. Rayford had told him it had been sloshing through the blood in the Valley of Megiddo, but apparently no one had reminded the potentate to get it cleaned. When it came into view, Mac's suspicions were confirmed. It was ringed with mud and blood to the windows. But sure enough, civilians lined the roadway on either side, cheering, waving, clapping, saluting, and throwing flowers. Carpathia opened the moonroof, stood on the front seat, and appeared in the open air, waving with both hands and blowing kisses. Enjoy it while it lasts, pal. Mac, do you see us? Rayford radioed over the secure frequency. No, where are you? Third row behind the Humvee. Nobody cares? It's as if they don't even see us. What's the plan? As the Humvee reaches Jaffa Road, it will head for the Jaffa Gate, along with a third of the fighting force. The other two-thirds will split off north and south, surrounding the old city. Once everyone is in place, Carpathia will lead the charge through the occupied Armenian and Jewish quarters to the Temple Mount. They plan to batter through the western wall and overtake the rebels. Plan to? Exactly. Mac finally spotted Rayford and Abdullah's Hummer and was struck by how much it looked like it belonged in the procession. As the cavalcade approached Jaffa Road, Mac began jogging that way, hoping to catch up with his friends when they peeled away from the group. The cheering crowds grew larger as the cars neared the old city, and as they slowed, the marching band caught up, its music blaring and drums pounding. Mac was reminded of Memorial Day parades as a child when his father had hoisted him on his shoulders and he had thrilled to the rat-a-tat-tat of the snares and the thumping undercurrent of the big bass drums. Back then, of course, he never heard Hail Carpathia. The music had stirred the crowd to a fever pitch, and the army that followed was clearly something unlike any of them, loyalists or rebels, had ever seen. There wouldn't be room in the old city for a fraction of the force. Mac wondered how even Carpathia and the rest of the rolling stock were going to navigate the narrow cobblestone streets. I've been wondering the same thing, Mac, Rayford said. This is some festival, eh? Ridiculous. Frankly, I love it, Rayford said. The more and the louder, the better. I don't follow. The more pomp and circumstance, the greater the humiliation later. Well, that, sure. You find us yet, Mac? I'm heading your way. When you gonna split off? We're not. You're not? What? You're gonna go parading into the old city with Carpathia? Why not? See if you can get in. Unlikely. Try. Mac caught up to the parade and had to wonder what all the extra troops were for. The same contingent of soldiers that had been there when he had discovered Buck was more than enough to get the job done from a human standpoint. If they couldn't do it, the rest wouldn't help. Fortunato steered the wide Humvee through Jaffa Gate, and almost immediately the folly of their plan became clear. There simply wasn't room for the rolling stock to proceed to the western wall of the Temple Mount. In his earplug, Mac heard Nikolai trying to enlist engineers to bring in heavy equipment and knock down buildings and walls en route. When told that would take hours, he exploded, swearing and demanding to know who told him his parade through the old city had been a capital idea. "Leave the cars where they are," he announced. "I shall lead the rest of the attack on horseback." Mac was close enough now to see Carpathia sneak a peek at the sky. Jesus wasn't there at the moment, and neither was his heavenly army, which Mac thought unnerved Carpathia more than if he'd been there. Aides immediately attended to Carpathia when he emerged from the Humvee. He straightened his leathers, which seemed no worse for wear, since he hadn't left the vehicle during the debacle in Megiddo. Nikolai also repositioned his garish sword. But when Fortunato got out, he was wearing plain civilian clothes that made him appear to be on his way to a work day for a local community service club. "Get the Reverend a proper uniform and something to clean his face and hair," Carpathia ordered. Someone ran off, returning presently. "Biggest we have," the man said, handing the folded clothes and a wet towel to Fortunato, who gave him a look that would lift roadkill off asphalt. "Sorry," the man whispered. "Biggest we have." "You can change in the cathedral," someone else told Leon, and he hurried off with a couple of aides. Meanwhile, more generals and hangers-on and toadies surrounded Carpathia, who asked that they make room for the photographers and TV camera crews. When Leon returned in the too-short, too-tight Unity Army getup, he looked like Sergeant Garcia trying to fit into Zorro's costume. He had tried to religiousize the outfit by hanging around his neck a large gold chain with 216 dangling from it. It was all Mac could do to keep a straight face. He fell into step with Rayford and Abdullah as they approached from their vehicle. They had begun to draw a few stares, fortunately not from anyone who cared enough to ask questions. All three wore caps pulled low over their foreheads, but they were way out of uniform if they were meant to be Unity Army personnel. "We'd better split up, eh, Cap?" Mac said. "I guess. Smitty, you go north. Mac, south. Meet you outside the eastern wall at the Golden Gate when this is all over." Chaim felt the tingle of anticipation as the remnant fell into place at a high point on the western slope overlooking Jerusalem. It still seemed disconcerting not to see Jesus above them, but he knew the Lord knew best. Antichrist had been crowing about luring the Son of God into his trap when it was clear to Chaim that the opposite had happened. Carpathia had to have read the Bible. He had to know all this was prophesied. He even had to know the predicted outcome. Yet he brazenly came to the very spot he was supposed to come to, and in spite of the mass execution of his troops in three other confrontations, still had the gall to believe he would prevail. This was going to be something to see, and Chaim wanted to say so to the assembled. He had no means to address them all at once, and from looking at those around him, he knew there was nothing they needed to be told. They, like he, looked on with great expectancy. "Ride on, King Jesus." Chapter 15. Rayford was close enough behind Nikolai that he heard him ask a woman general, "What is our equestrian strength?" She checked via radio and reported, "Excellency, of more than 1 million soldiers, a little more than 1/10 are on horseback. Call for as many steeds as we need to get the first wave to the western wall, and order Reverend Fortunato and me appropriate mounts." Within minutes, several thousand horses crowded the streets, and Unity Army soldiers were mounting up. A tall, handsome stallion, almost identical to the one Carpathia had ridden out of the city toward Basra, was delivered for his use. Cameras clicked and TV crews crowded around as he swung aboard, raising his sword. He twirled the blade above his head, rousing the troops, who responded with a crescendoing whoop like a football team about to break from the locker room. Fortunato struggled up onto a smaller black horse and settled himself. "Follow me to the western wall," Carpathia shouted. "And make way for the battering ram and missile launchers. Upon my command, open fire." Knowing the old city by now, Rayford sprinted for side streets, heading toward the western wall. Mac was already at the southern corner of the old city, a few steps north of Dung Gate. Abdullah contacted him by radio and said he had found a perch near Antonia's fortress and believed he was safe and undetectable, with a good view of the approaching invaders. "I am high enough to see the surrounding army forces too, Mac," he said. "They have the entire old city encircled, several thousand deep. I can see why they are so confident of victory, having cut off all escape routes 360 degrees. Rayford set up 100 yards short of the western wall and far enough south that he had some underbrush for cover. He thought he saw Mac, but couldn't be sure. Almost everyone inside the old city but the press was part of the attacking force, but the occasional civilian stood atop anything available, cheering and shouting encouragement as Carpathia came into view, valiant and proud on his huge horse, sword pointing to the sky, microphone wrapped around his ear and in front of his mouth so the entire army could hear his commands. "For the glory of your risen master and lord of the earth," he shouted, urging his ride to a full gallop, clacking over the cobblestone ground. Fortunato's horse mint-stepped slowly after, which seemed plenty fast enough for Leon. The band lagged behind the mounted and rolling and marching troops, loudly clanging out a rousing melody. As Carpathia drew within range of the wall, he peeled off to the south with Fortunato trailing him. "Horsemen, make way for the armaments," Carpathia bellowed. "Attack! Break through the wall! Take the temple mount! Destroy the rebels!" But when the horsemen whipped their mounts, they did not make way. Rather, the horses bolted as if blind, nickering, whinnying, braying, rearing, bucking, kicking, spinning into each other, running headlong into the wall, throwing riders. "Make way!" Carpathia screamed. "Make way!" The riders, not thrown, leaped from their horses and tried to control them with the reins, but even as they struggled, their own flesh dissolved, their eyes melted, and their tongues disintegrated. As Rayford watched, the soldiers stood briefly as skeletons in now baggy uniforms, then dropped in heaps of bones as the blinded horses continued to fume and rant and rave. Seconds later, the same plague afflicted the horses, their flesh and eyes and tongues melting away, leaving grotesque skeletons standing before they too clanked to the pavement. "Reinforcements!" Carpathia called out. "Charge! Charge! Fire! Fire! Attack!" But every horse and rider that advanced suffered the same fate. First blindness and madness on the part of the horses, then the bodies of the soldiers melting and dissolving, then the falling and piling of the bones. Rayford stood, mouth agape, noticing that neither Carpathia's nor Fortunato's horses had been affected yet. Leon slid off his mount and flopped to the ground, rolling to a kneeling position and burying his face in his hands. "Get up, Leon! Get up! We're not defeated! We have a million more soldiers and we shall prevail!" But Leon stayed where he was, whimpering and wailing. Plainly disgusted, Nikolai urged his horse back to the middle of the wall and looked past the bones of his decimated troops for reinforcements. He lifted his sword and cursed God, but suddenly his attention was drawn directly above. Rayford followed his gaze to see the temple of God opened in heaven and the Ark of the Covenant plain as day. Lightning flashed and thunder roared, and the earth began to shift. Carpathia's horse reared and high-stepped, and Nikolai fought to control him. Fortunato's horse scampered away without him. The earth groaned and buckled, and the city of Jerusalem was fractured into three as the great fissures swallowed up Carpathia loyalists and soldiers. Buildings and walls were left intact, except Abdullah reported seeing the cemented-over eastern gate, closed off for centuries, blasted open by the movement of the earth. Rayford slapped his palm over his earpiece and plugged his other ear to hear reports coming in from all over the world. The earthquake was global. Islands disappeared. Mountains were leveled. The entire face of the planet had been made level, save for the city of Jerusalem itself. And suddenly, the Lord Jesus himself appeared in the clouds again, and the whole world saw him. He spoke with a loud voice, saying, "Speak comfort to Jerusalem, and cry out to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity is pardoned, for she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. Every valley has been exalted, and every mountain and hill brought low. The crooked places have been made straight, and the rough places smooth. The glory of the Lord has been revealed, and all flesh have seen it together, for I have spoken. Behold, the day of the Lord has come, and your spoil has been divided in your midst. For I gathered all the nations to battle against Jerusalem, but the remnant of the people was not cut off from the city. I went forth and fought against those nations as in the day of battle. And the plague with which I struck all the people who fought against Jerusalem was this: their flesh dissolved while they stood on their feet, their eyes dissolved in their sockets, and their tongues dissolved in their mouths. I sent a great panic over them. Such also was the plague on the horses. Behold, I made Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness to all the surrounding peoples when they laid siege against Judah and Jerusalem, and I made Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all peoples. All who would heave it away were surely cut in pieces, though all nations of the earth were gathered against it. I struck every horse with confusion, and its rider with madness. I opened my eyes on the house of Judah, and struck every horse of the peoples with blindness. I defended the inhabitants of Jerusalem. The one who was feeble among them today is like David, and the house of David shall be like God, like the angel of the Lord before them. I destroyed all the nations that came against Jerusalem. Therefore the curse has devoured the earth, and those who dwell in it are desolate. Therefore the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men are left. In the midst of the land among the people, it was like the shaking of an olive tree, like the gleaning of grapes when the vintage is done. The children of Israel called on my name, and I answered them. I said, "This is my people." And each one said, "The Lord is my God." Though the Lord did not speak audibly to the remnant, Chaim felt as if he and they were being drawn inexorably around the old city to the east side. As the million-plus slowly made their way past the dead and the dying, a fraction of Antichrist's forces remained alive. They struggled and staggered toward shelter, also apparently drawn to the east. The Lord sat triumphant on the back of his white horse in the clouds, his army behind him, gazing upon the one-sided victory over the forces that had come against Jerusalem. Matt found Rayford, and they went looking for Abdullah. They knew he was all right because they had radio contact. He, too, was headed east of the city. "You should have seen Nikolai and Leon," Rayford said.
"I saw them briefly," Mac said, "when Leon fell off his horse."
Nikolai galloped off a little while ago, heading back the way he had come. Leon was running after him, pleading to let him ride along, but Carpathia ignored him.
"Figures."
The earth still shifted and moved from aftershocks, and Rayford tried to imagine what it must look like from outer space. No more islands, no more mountains, virtually flat with gently rolling hills. The whole of Israel, except for Jerusalem, was level. They found Abdullah, who at first looked past them, then smiled and shook his head.
"I was looking for two white men, Mac."
Hannah Pale Moon caught up with Chaim, who was surrounded by people with questions. She waited until he recognized her, then said, "How long until we are reunited with loved ones who went on to heaven before us?"
"Very soon, I hope," Chaim said. "There are many I wish to see, too, but first I want to see Jesus face to face."
"What next?"
"Oh, I think you know. The Lord himself will set foot on earth again for only the second time since his ascension. As you know, he came in the clouds for the rapture, and this time he briefly walked on the ground when he soiled his robe in blood at Bozra."
"Is the enemy completely gone?" Hannah said.
"Soon," Chaim said. "Very soon."
Illinois, flat as it already was hardly affected by the earthquake, though Enoch was certain no one doubted what had happened. The long, low rumbling of the earth continued, and he heard Carpathia loyalists screaming for their lives. Enoch had begun moving his furniture upstairs, looking forward to a life where he could look out the window without caring who might see in. Just before the earthquake, one of the few Global Community Peacekeeper patrol cars he had seen in recent weeks raced down the street. As it came around the curve in front of his place, it veered off the road and hit a fire hydrant. Neighbors ran to the car, collapsing in disbelief when all they found were skeletons and clothes in the front seat. The declared enemies of God were being decimated around the world. Enoch tried calling his parishioners, reaching many and missing several who called while he was on the phone. No one was hurt, though some of their homes were damaged. Several were badly shaken, telling of seeing government employees disintegrating before their eyes, and all wanted to talk about their new church, where it might be, and how soon they might move into it. Many also mentioned their pilgrimage to the Middle East.
"I don't know when it's gonna be,"
one woman told Enoch,
"but I'll be along whenever."
Enoch reminded each that sometime after the earthquake, Jesus would set foot on the Mount of Olives east of Jerusalem, and the whole world would see him.
"Keep looking up."
"You still in a teaching mood, Smitty?" Mac said.
"That depends on whether I have studied whatever you are curious about."
"The Mount of Olives, of course."
"Oh, yes, I have studied it thoroughly. You can see it from here, naturally. It is only half a mile from the eastern wall of the old city. It is really more of a hill than a mountain, as you can tell. One of Jesus' most famous sermons was preached there. When he made his triumphal entry, he came from the Mount of Olives. And he returned there every night of the last week before the crucifixion, often praying in the Garden of Gethsemane. The transfiguration took place there later, too.
So it makes sense that's where he wants to come now.
It certainly does to me, Abdullah said. George Sebastian had never seen anything like it. He told Priscilla he would catch up with her and the kids and the rest of the Tribulation Force traveling with the Remnant. He lagged, and rather than following the Remnant around the devastated city, he decided to cut directly through it on his way to the Mount of Olives. As a career military man, Sebastian had seen the spoils of war before, of course, on many fields of battle around the world. He could not recall, however, a quaint, beautiful city so devastated. Most peculiar, it was nearly impossible to determine who had won. Sebastian had been kept up to speed on the conflict from the beginning and knew from Buck and then Mac how the city had been completely overrun by the Global Community Unity Army. Half the residents had been killed or captured. Many were still imprisoned and had been tortured and starved. But now, as he ambled through the narrow streets, George saw on the one hand surviving Unity soldiers leisurely dividing the spoils, others regrouping for an assault on rebels who would try to escape from the Temple Mount, and piles of clothes and bones where the Lord had decomposed the bodies of his enemies. So this was not over. Jerusalem, the jewel city of God, had been violated to the point of ruin. It was a wonder God himself had not leveled it along with the mountains and islands of the world. Sebastian scanned the entire area as he walked, heading north to Herod's Gate, where he knew Buck had been killed. He climbed the wall and looked out over the rest of Jerusalem. Perhaps 100,000 of Carpathia's troops remained. The rebels still held the Temple Mount, guarding the newly opened East Gate, rather than choosing to try to escape through it. He could see the vast remnant slowly making its way past the south wall, heading toward the Mount of Olives, and knew he had better catch up or risk leaving his wife with the responsibility of two youngsters by herself. Of course, others would help, but that didn't justify his abandoning her. Just before Sebastian made his way back down from the wall, he saw a flurry of activity outside the new gate in the northwest corner of the old city. It appeared the press had surrounded Nikolai and Leon, and what was left of the potentate's cabinet of advisors and generals. Sebastian shook his head. He knew what was coming, and Carpathia had to as well. Why wasn't he running for his life? Some men never knew when they were beat, never knew when to fold and walk away. Nikolai Carpathia, proving, as if that were necessary, that he was indeed Antichrist, was the epitome of that kind of a man. In a classic case of cosmic denial, his pride still persuaded him he could not lose in the end. There he stood, pointing, cajoling, scheming, barking orders, talking to the press. Sebastian fired up his radio, and sure enough, His Highness was still trying to sell the citizenry on their eventual triumph. "This city shall become my throne," Carpathia said. "The temple will be flattened and the way made for my palace, the most magnificent structure ever erected. We have captured half the enemy here, and we will dispose of the other half in due time. The final stage of our conquest is nearly ready to be executed, and we will soon be rid of this nuisance from above." Rayford, Mac, and Abdullah had also been listening as they watched the crawl of people, mostly the remnant, moving toward the Mount of Olives. Of course, the children of God knew what was supposed to come, and so they kept their distance. No one had any idea of the Lord's timing, but there he remained, hovering over them with his horsemen, and soon he began again to speak words of comfort to his own. "As you have received me as your Lord, So walk in me, rooted and built up in me, and established in the faith, as you have been taught, abounding with thanksgiving. You are complete in me, the head of all principality and power. My Father has said unto me, Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. A scepter of righteousness is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated lawlessness. Therefore God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness more than your companions. You laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. Others will perish, but you remain, and they will all grow old like a garment. Like a cloak, you will fold them up, and they will be changed. But you are the same, and your years will not fail. And I, the one about whom these things were said by God Himself, assure you, my children, that I will never leave you nor forsake you. So you may boldly say, The Lord is my helper, I will not fear. What can man do to me? I, your Lord Jesus Christ, am the same yesterday, today, and forever. Therefore, holy brothers and sisters, partakers of the heavenly calling, consider me the apostle and high priest of your confession. I was faithful to God who appointed me, as Moses also was faithful. For I was counted worthy of more glory than Moses, in the same way that God, who built the house, has more honor than the house. For every house is built by someone, but he who built all things is God. God has set me as a high priest fitting for you. Holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, and higher than the heavens. I do not need daily, as human high priests, to offer up sacrifices, first for my own sins and then for the people's, for this I did once for all when I offered up myself. Despite all Jesus' magnanimous comments about himself, Rayford was struck by how lowly, humble, and compassionate he sounded. He was merely speaking the truth, reminding his children what they enjoyed in him. The truth of the Word of God, coming from the living Word, again drove Rayford to his knees, along with his friends and the entire Jewish remnant. As Rayford knelt, his face in his hands on the ground, Jesus continued to speak directly to his heart. God willed to make known the riches of the glory of this mystery, which is Christ in you, Rayford, the hope of glory. I am the hope of Israel, the horn of salvation in the house of God's servant David. Most assuredly I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. Jesus fell silent. From the west, Rayford heard the Global Community Unity Army marching band. Their weak rendition of Hail Carpathia sounded discordant from a distance, and of course it paled in comparison to the murmured prayers of the million on their knees before the Lord in the sky. The ground rumbled as what was left of the GC's armaments were rolled into position. It was pathetic and laughable to Rayford that Carpathia had not learned anything from the past several hours. There would be no competing with this force from heaven. No damage would be done to him or to his people with weapons of war. And yet here Carpathia came, horse at full stride, leathers squeaking in the saddle, sword aloft, the pitiable false prophet bouncing awkwardly along behind him, holding the reins of his horse for all he was worth. The remnant stood as one, as if to not miss a thing.
Rayford looked fully into the face of his lord and was again reminded of the biblical description of the man on the white horse with eyes like fire. The conviction that shone in the eyes of Jesus was of one who had finally had enough. His enemy was right where he wanted him, lured fully into the trap that had been set before the foundation of the world. The fulfillment of age-old prophecies was about to take place, despite the fact that the enemy himself had read them, knew them, and had seen every last one of them come to fruition exactly as it had been laid out. In all his sick imitative glory came galloping the quintessence of pride and ego, indwelt by Satan himself. Carpathia swung his sword round and round above his head, while Fortunato used one hand to attempt some sort of a weird gesture of worship, and the other to keep control of his horse and himself in the saddle. The band which led the way played louder and louder and, on cue, split right and left to allow the mounted soldiers, then the foot soldiers, then the munitions and armament platoons in rolling vehicles to slowly come into position. With the remnant just a few hundred yards to the east, the besieged city of Jerusalem a half mile to the west, and the heavenly hosts hovering directly above, Jesus nudged his magnificent white charger and descended to the top of the Mount of Olives. As he dismounted, Carpathia shrieked out his final command, "Attack!" The 100,000 troops followed orders, horsemen at the gallop and firing, foot soldiers running and firing, rolling stock rolling and firing. And Jesus said in that voice like a trumpet and the sound of rushing waters, "I am who I am." At that instant, the Mount of Olives split in two from east to west, the place Jesus stood moving to the north and the place where the Unity Army stood moving to the south, leaving a large valley. All the firing and the running and the galloping and the rolling stopped. The soldiers screamed and fell, their bodies bursting open from head to toe at every word that proceeded out of the mouth of the Lord as he spoke to the captives within Jerusalem. "You shall flee through my mountain valley, for the mountain valley reaches to Azal. Yes, you shall flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. The Lord your God has come, and all the saints with me." With shouts and singing, it was as if Jerusalem burst forth. The captives who had been imprisoned in Jerusalem came running toward the great rift between the two sides of the Mount of Olives. And as the earth continued to rumble and shift, Rayford watched in awe as the whole city of Jerusalem rose above the ground some 300 feet and now stood as an exalted jewel above all the surrounding land that had been flattened by the global earthquake. Max struggled to his feet and grabbed Rayford. "You see him?" he said, pointing. "See Nikolai and Leon lighting out for safety? And look at that big glob of bobbing light bouncing along ahead of him. Remember what I told you about Lucifer showing up at Solomon's stables? That's got to be him, and he's deserted old Nick again." Mac and Abdullah and Rayford stood, arms around each other's shoulders, taking in the spectacular scene. As the rebels from the Temple Mount and the captives fled through the new valley, the last feeble vestiges of the Unity Army chased them, only to die at the words of Jesus. "Living waters shall flow from Jerusalem," he said, "half of them toward the eastern sea and half of them toward the western sea. In both summer and winter it shall occur, and I, the Lord, shall be king over all the earth. Today the Lord is one and his name one. All the land has been turned into a plain from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem. Jerusalem has been raised up and inhabited in her place from Benjamin's gate to the place of the first gate and the corner gate, and from the tower of Hananiel to the king's wine presses. You, the people, shall dwell in it,
And no longer shall there be utter destruction, but Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited. With that, Jesus mounted his horse and began his final triumphal entry toward Jerusalem. During his first visit to earth, he had ridden into the city on a lowly donkey, welcomed by some, but rejected by most. Now he rode high on the majestic white steed, and with every word that came from his mouth, the rest of the enemies of God, but for Satan, the Antichrist, and the false prophet, were utterly destroyed where they stood. This is the day of vengeance, that all things which were written have been fulfilled. The loftiness of man shall be bowed down, and the haughtiness of men shall be brought low. The Lord alone will be exalted today. Loud voices from heaven said, "The kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. We give you thanks, O Lord God Almighty, the one who is and who was and who is to come, because you have taken your great power and reigned. The nations were angry, and your wrath has come, and the time of the dead, that they should be judged, and that you should reward your servants, the prophets and the saints, and those who fear your name, small and great, and should destroy those who destroy the earth." The remnant trailed Jesus, raising their hands, singing hosannas and praising him. They fell silent when he spoke again. "It is a righteous thing with God to repay with tribulation those who trouble you, and to give you, who are troubled, rest. I have taken vengeance on those who do not know God and on those who do not obey my gospel. These shall be punished with everlasting destruction from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his power. I have come to be glorified in my saints and to be admired among all those who believe." Chapter 16. Kneeling in his front yard in suburban Chicago, Enoch wept at the glorious triumphant words of Christ. He also wept because of his deep longing to be in Jerusalem. He had studied these passages for years and knew what was happening. He couldn't wait to get there, to reunite with his friends from the tribulation force and to hear every detail of the great day of God the Almighty. More than anything, however, he wanted to see Jesus. With every moment, it became more and more difficult for Rayford to take in the magnitude of the supernatural events. Sensory overload was a gross understatement. He never once had to pinch himself to determine whether this was a dream. It was all so real, so massive, that even what he might have considered smaller miracles took their place alongside the global and local earthquakes in importance. Like the fact that he still felt no fatigue despite no rest, let alone sleep, in he didn't know how long. But when he and Mac and Abdullah parked the Hummer outside the old city and followed the vast procession in the newly burst-open east gate, a new phenomenon awaited him. It was one thing to follow his Lord, the King of Kings, on his ultimate triumphal entry into the city of David, but to see what he saw there compared with what he expected to find. Jerusalem, particularly the old city, should have been filled with the gore of the dead. Hundreds of thousands had been slain here, the majority in most grotesque ways. There should have been stench, blood, and flesh, not to mention the skeletal remains of Unity Army soldiers and horses. But the earthquake that had rent in two the Mount of Olives and elevated the Eternal City some 300 feet had accomplished a macabre cleanup operation as well.
Jesus led the happy throng in and around the inside borders of the old city, stretching the parade of singing, dancing, chanting, embracing, praising, worshiping, celebrating people for several miles. Strangely, the walls had been leveled, all of them. No more battle scars, no more jagged edges from bombs and battering rams, no more uneven levels. Where the walls had stood were gently rolling mounds of fine, crushed stone. Even the wailing wall had disappeared, and Rayford had the full-hearted feeling that Jesus had replaced it with himself. Sure enough, as the head of the procession came within sight of the western wall, Jesus began to speak. And while in the saddle he was only slightly higher than the people in line and was facing away from them, Rayford knew all could hear him as clearly as he himself could about a third of the way back in the throng. "There is one God and one mediator between God and men, I, the man Christ Jesus. I gave myself a ransom for all." Where was the residue of war? Rayford could only guess. It was as if the city had been shaken and tilted this way and that, and while the buildings and landmarks remained, the rubble of the walls had apparently scrubbed the streets and pushed the gruesome evidence, all of it, into crevasses now covered over for the rest of eternity. The city of God was pristine anew, and the people seemed astonished by it. When the Lord